Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride, and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze.
Interesting people, a lot of actors, and famous people like William Boeing was born today. Those of you who like Walt Disney and enjoyed the classical music conducted by the great Polish-Irish conductor Leopold Stokowski and his famous hands, he never used a baton. Great musician. Unfortunately, I didn't study under him. Wanted to. But anyway, Fantasia, the lovely music that you hear and you see on the screen, Mickey Mouse loping about. That's the music is Paul Dukas' Sorcerer. So it's his birthday today. And then we also have the birthday of William Boeing, the great aviator, not aviator, but inventor of the famous Boeing planes and the factory up in Seattle. And all of those planes, when you see the designation B-25, B-17, B-29, B-36, all of that, B-50, that means Boeing made them. And they're still the premier airplane manufacturer here in the United States. And even to the world, they're still, I guess, developing what is called the Dreamliner, which is a lighter plane, supposedly fuel efficient, to compete with the Aerobus. And then those of you who remember the Concorde, which was noisy and messy, was out here on the West Coast very briefly, and nobody wanted it to land. I think Bill Buckley of the National Review, that magazine, conservative, his brother was James Buckley, the senator from New York. And the Buckley family, just to digress, the father was an oil buccaneer. He went to Mexico and drilled for oil and all of that. That's where the Buckley family money came from. But anyway, excuse me, he took the last flight of the Concorde around the world. I don't know what it cost. It must have been some flight considering that the plane was obsolete before it was even built and wasn't fuel efficient. It was extremely noisy and British. It was a British and a French collaboration to challenge the American supremacy of aircraft which was sold around the world. The Russians couldn't carry a candle to it, although the Russians did build some great planes, but the maintenance and the quality control was atrocious. They were always falling out of the sky, from what I understand. Among the birthdays today, interesting, Stanley Holloway, who was the bass bum, had a great bass voice, and in My Fair Lady. Also, the star in My Fair Lady on Broadway was Julie Andrews, excuse me, who she has that unusual voice. She has a, I guess you could call it a physical defect, which she turned into a big asset. And she was born today, and they starred on Broadway in the first version of My Fair Lady. And then the movie version, since Julie Andrews was not that well known and did not have that kind of box office so that the investors, the studios, could recoup their money and then some, I think they used Audrey Hepburn, who can't sing, but they when they do that, they get a singer and they dub the voice. Same thing happened in the version of South Pacific. I think it was Marnie Nixon who sang, and Mary Martin debuted the part on Broadway back in 1950 with Ezio Pinza, who was an Italian opera singer. And he couldn't read music, but he had a great ear. And there are people like that who have a great ear and can learn a role without being able to read or having learned to read music. Kate Smith was another one. And another great musician was born today, and he's interesting. He was a Russian Jewish emigre, Vladimir Horowitz, one of the greatest pianists of all time, and he married Arturo Toscanini's daughter Wanda. She handled the money and everything, and of course the great Arturo Toscanini, one of the greatest conductors. He was a guy who could hear, he'd learn a score in his memory, and he could play it on the piano or conduct it from memory, and then he was the one that NBC started the famous NBC Symphony, and they did these concerts over the radio, and he lasted till about 1955, I think, and it was earlier, 53 or 54, his mind went blank, and the engineers in the studio suddenly cut off the sound and said, "We're having difficulty," and whatever. Then he remembered and conducted, and he never conducted again. excuse me. So, and then Toscanini was—he hated fascism. He refused to conduct, and he was boycotted in Italy when because he was Italian, and he would go to La Scala, which is the great opera house in Milan. Excuse me. And then he also refused to conduct at Bayreuth. He loved Wagner, and Hitler, of course, embraced Wagner and made Nordic nonsense out of it. But he was Arturo Toscanini. Was one of the great musicians who stood up for his principles and refused to support Nazism by conducting music in places where Nazism, like Austria, was celebrated. Also today, talking about Nazism, we had 1938, Hitler annexed the Sudetenland, and the British and the French let him get away with it. This is where Neville Chamberlain comes in, and I think that not Paul Reynaud, but the other French premier, Deladier, agreed, and Mussolini and Hitler were at the infamous meeting where they carved up Czechoslovakia, and that was just the beginning. They sharpened their knives for more, and, of course, we got World War I, September 1st, 1939, 11 months later. Among the other birthdays today of these politicians, we had the first Asian ethnic became a U.S. senator, Hiram Fong in Hawaii. He was a banker. They say in Hawaii that the Japanese run the politics, the Chinese control the finances, and the Filipinos and the Native Hawaiians either work in the fields or beat up hollies. I don't know how true that is, but that's what they say. And then a controversial, colorful mayor of Los Angeles, Sam Yorty, was born today. We have one of the great historians, Daniel Borstein. He was born today. And another great actor is Walter Matthau. Now, it's kind of funny. One of the last movies he made was First Monday in October, where he played a cantankerous associate U.S. Supreme Court judge, and there had just been a woman, I forgot her name, who was appointed the first woman on the bench. It was kind of like Olive Reagan appointing a woman from Arizona, Sandra Day O'Connor. And she was, quote, the liberal, and they used to spar with each other and then became great friends. So it's kind of timely. And then another great actor who played Harry Truman, James Whitmore. He was born today. And then we have Jimmy Carter. He was born today, president, and also served in the Navy, although he kind of hyped his career. He did was on a submarine. He worked with Admiral Rickover, but he may have exaggerated his importance of his experience and expertise. And then we have Tom Bosley, who played Fiorello, great actor. He was born in Chicago, great voice. And then we had Stella Stevens, great actress. Oh, I forgot, this U.S. Supreme Court justice, he was around. William Rehnquist, who's from Arizona, moderate conservative, and was complaining about what Steve Neri experienced when he filed his legal brief in the U.S. Supreme Court, and we'll get into that, and it'll be up on the web. When the certiorari clerks, what's happened is across the country, and from the local court level, the state court level, federal court level, all the way up to Supreme Court, there is has been this assault, this infiltration of clerks and staff attorneys who have their own agenda, and some of them are homosexual activists, and there's a growing controversy about that. This may also have led to the resignation or retirement of Judge Walker here in the Ninth Circuit here in San Francisco, who is gay and who has caused a lot of problems with his decision overturning the will of the voters in California on Proposition 8. So, and nobody knows who his clerks are. They're not, they may be gay, but you've got to realize that there's a very heavy caseload in the federal courts, and these judges don't have the time to go through every legal brief. That's why they have clerks and staff attorneys, and these people are not supposed to bring their biases and prejudices or be bribed to hijack or dump a case in the circular wastebasket there. Which is what happened with Stephen Neri, a U.S. Navy sailor. It's going into 16 years now, but this it's like Banco's ghost. It's not going to go away. It's that type of a case. And let's see. Oh, and some other actors, the famous Lawrence Harvey. Great film. I think one of his best films was Darling, where this was made in the 60s with this great actress, Julie Christie, and it was a depiction of the mores of the British, I guess you could say yuppies at the time, and their lifestyle, anything goes, and Julie Christie slept her way to the top of the modeling field and ended up marrying an Italian duke. Great film in black and white, and Lawrence Harvey played one of her lovers, and he told her she was, in effect, simply a slut. And then Richard Harris, great actor, gravelly voice. He played a role in A Man Called Horace, but my favorite role and one of my favorite characters in history, although it was a despicable behavior toward the Irish and Catholics, in the role Cromwell. But he said something when he overthrew the Charles I, the Stuart monarchy, first part of it, when he ousted the members of Parliament and said, you guys can't even run a proper whorehouse. And so he had his roundheads come in. That was his army. And he forced all these parliamentarians out of the House of Commons. And, of course, there was the Great War. He was known as the Great Commoner. And he had the wars in Ireland and abused the Catholics, and they've never forgiven Cromwell for that. And then those of you who read Rolling Stone, the photographer who does a lot of work or has done for them was Anne Leibovitz. She was born today. And then the doping scandal with the baseball players, Mark McGwire, he was born today. And among the interesting events in history and in this date, Alexander the Great, who was, I guess, bisexual, he defeated the Persians. And, of course, he ended up dying in India, what is now India. And then in 1869, we had the first postcard was developed in Vienna, Austria. In 1885, I guess we don't have this anymore, special mail delivery was inaugurated in the United States. And then also the Jews were expelled from Kiev in Russia, and many of them emigrated to the United States, ended up in the ghettos in New York, Chicago, mostly New York, because it was closer. And then in 1908, Henry Ford introduced the Model T, and it cost $825. And then in 1936, we had the Generalissimo Franco in the Spanish Civil War. He established the new state of Spain and didn't have a king until much later. He was one of the longest lasting dictators. Since it's a political time of the year, we've got an election coming up. I interviewed some time ago one of the last real journalists in San Francisco. He's not there anymore. And we were discussing politicians and animals. His name was Larry Liebert, and we're going to play his interview. It's a little long, but I think you'll enjoy it, and it's most informative.
Distinguished journalist on the San Francisco Chronicle, Larry Liebert. Welcome to Animals and Ideas, Larry.
Thank you, Peter.
Larry, Larry, recently you used the phrase in one of your columns called The Pitfalls of Politics. How did you arrive at that?
Well, I was thinking of, I was writing then about the political consultants, the sort of hired guns who act and set policy for the candidates. And I was trying to think of an image that suggested a certain trained fierceness about them. And I thought back to the alliteration always helps. You end up with pitfalls of politics. I thought back to the stories of those trained attack dogs, the pitfalls. I guess the question is whether I was being unfair to all pitfalls. It's not necessarily an unfair comparison, because neither are all political consultants as fierce, and neither do they attack as viciously. But as a breed, they're a pretty tough breed, and it seemed a pretty good metaphor at the time.
You also used the phrase in recently called the Grizzly Bear Caucus. Does that have to do with the history of California?
Well, I'll tell you what that came. That one I didn't make up myself, but I mentioned it. Some liberal Democrats up in Sacramento in the Assembly, Tom Hayden's one of them, a very liberal guy, and Tom Bates from the Bay Area, and a few of the others formed a little group, and they were looking for a name to describe. And I think it's a natural tendency to look for a mascot. I think you're right. It's the California Bear symbol. They were probably sitting there looking up at the flag over the Capitol, and I believe they've got the grizzly bear symbol up there in the Assembly chambers, and they wanted some somewhat ironic and amusing name for themselves. So they said, as they explained it to me, they decided to call themselves the Grizzly Bear Democrats, because liberals are sort of an endangered species. And yet, even though they're endangered, they said they can be pretty fierce when attacked, when riled, that you can't count them out. And so they thought that was a nice, feisty image with, as you say, with the bear symbol and a California flag and the seal. I guess they decided that had a nice California ring to it. So there you have another animal that seemed a natural.
Well, at least it wasn't our early flag, the Rattler, don't tread on me.
That's right. That would not have had that same, they didn't want to be quite that antagonistic, I think, to the rest of the legislators.
Larry, why do you think today that we don't see much of the animal side of politicians? In years past, we'd see the family pose and the family dog or cat or bird.
Well, I think one of the things is you still see, especially when people think it's relevant to conveying a certain image now, you'll still see the family and sometimes with the pet. I think one of the problems is that people are a little more skeptical about that campaign symbolism, so you have to be a little more sophisticated. And these days, if you just pose a politician with his dog, people have seen it so many times that they think it looks gimmicky. Now, if you can work it out, so you have a commercial, say, with the family, and they're all running on the beach, and the dogs are there too, and it fits in. You'll still see that sometimes, but
Robert Kennedy did that, running down the beach with his dog trailing.
Well, of course, the Reagans have a dog now, and
Bouvier, it's a police dog,
and it's a beautiful dog. And you see, I just saw some pictures in a national magazine one of those tabloids you leaf through at the supermarket stand. In fact, White House photos released of Nancy personally shampooing the dog. And that dog has fit in other ways with making Nancy Reagan a more human figure in recent months. She showed herself, even before the president's recent illness, she's shown a more human side. She hasn't been afraid to say, yes, I get involved in some decisions in the White House. But also, from that image of the queen with all the fancy dresses early in the presidency, when she's out on the ranch with the president, which is riding horses with him, and now when they're taking that sometimes finicky dog along with them onto the helicopter to Camp David, you do see a human side. So you still see animals. Perhaps they're not used as in the same stunts they were used in before, simply because people have seen it so often. I was just remembering, too, when you mentioned politicians posing with their dogs and everything, the second time Jerry Brown ran for governor, because he was a bachelor, his opponent, Evel Younger, who lost miserably in that race, but his commercials and his pieces all said, Evel Younger is a family man. Evel Younger understands the problems of a family. And so I remember on election night, I found Jerry Brown, who knew he was going to win big. This was before his downfall, but win big for re-election as governor. And he was walking into this big hotel in L.A., and I said, well, how do you feel, governor? And he says, look. And almost furtively, he pulled out of his coat pocket, his inside pocket, a little Polaroid, and he said, see, this is me with my dog. I'm a family guy, too. And it was a little joke picture that somebody had done of Jerry Brown with his arm around somebody's dog, and a little Polaroid. He was carrying that around, sort of saying, I guess he was really basically sort of saying, well, I'm tired of this nonsense of you have to pose with the family and the dog. And he said, I've got my dog, too. So he didn't quite take that seriously.
Of course, in the history of the White House, one president was supposed to have had an alligator. Do you think that exotic pets would turn some people off towards possibly voting for that candidate?
Yeah, I think obviously there's so many other things you could do, but if you're really, that would turn people off. But I think people like, if you're talking about high office and if you're talking about the presidency or the governor, people invest a certain sense of themselves. They want to see, if not Ozzie and Harriet, they at least want to see something that they can identify with. So if you've got a gator, they might begin to think there's something a little strange going on there. And even a more routine, a hamster would offend some people. And I'll bet you one of those pit bulls, one of those political managers, would tell a candidate whose family had a hamster, you better keep it out of the pictures because some people will get pretty upset. It still helps to have dogs, obviously. Not as many people like cats, those who do love them tremendously, though. And you have, obviously, horseback riding politicians. Reagan is the best known. Gary Hart, though, who was riding horses whenever he could in the campaign.
Mondale wasn't.
Mondale was a fisherman. Now, that even as was Jimmy Carter before him, so that doesn't seem to be a good luck area these days for politicians.
Do you think, since you mentioned horseback, do you think people subconsciously in times of trouble want a man on horseback or that concept?
I think that still, if you have someone who they trust or believe in or whose policies they like, in politics it is a powerful symbolism, and obviously it's manipulated by all these political professionals, but they like for things to fit together. And if they can see someone like Ronald Reagan, who is unabashed hokiness, even it lives this sort of cowboy image, has that kind of response, and certainly has shown cases of his surgery and the assassination attempt, can show courage in how he handles things, it creates a very powerful mythology. And so, yes, they do like that, if it works. Now, a candidate who did not have that sort of natural style about him, if you have a candidate, remember when Richard Nixon, they sent him off to walk on the beach for the cameras to show him relaxing, and the cameras were all stationed above, and he was walking along in his suit with his dress shoes on the beach. It wasn't convincing. And the same
incongruous.
Incongruous, exactly. It just did not fit. So if it fits for a Ronald Reagan, if he was a horse, if he was the dog, that can reinforce and make people feel comfortable with what is, after all, called the first family. It really is, whether it's fair or not, or relevant to running the country, it really is sort of a reflection of our idealized image of ourselves.
Larry, if an aspiring young politico were to come to you and ask you what type of image, say animal-wise, that they should try to project, what would you advise them?
Well, I think the first thing is that you cannot, if you are by nature rough-hewn, if you have naturally a rural area, a home in the country, then by all means go horseback riding and show that in your campaign pictures and all that. Even then, some people suspect it's hokey. But if you're not, you might do a dog at best, and even at that, it could look like a stunt. The important thing is that even though all of this may be stage managed, it has to have a certain believability. Right now, John Garamendi, who's a state senator, would like to run for governor on the Democratic side. He's far back of Tom
Bradley.
Who would likely be the nominee. But Garamendi's campaign brochures all include somewhere inside him riding a horse, working on his ranch where he grew up. He's got a legitimate claim. Now, the trick is, I noticed that in a well-designed leaflet, they sort of work that imagery in commercials, if he could ever afford them, get far enough along the race. They're smart. They'll work that in. It won't be the whole theme because, again, if you have him talking to a cow or riding a horse in all of his film, people will begin to sense that it's a gimmick. If it fits the overall picture of what you're doing, that could be a very powerful help to a candidate like him.
So what you're saying, in essence, that Willie Brown ought to stick to his Porsche and not try to get on a horse if he wants to run for another office.
Well, you know, he's ridden horse. Actually, he can ride horses and does. And I remember seeing some pictures of him doing it. I'm not sure that would be terribly convincing either, though. I tell you, I did a story on a little column a couple of years ago because a neighbor of Willie Brown's, back before Willie and his wife were separated, I don't know if they're divorced or not yet, but when they were living up on Upper Masonic, said, "Willie Brown's dog keeps me awake all night long." And the fellow was really furious, and I wrote a story about the Speaker of the Assembly who is unable to keep his dog from barking in the night. And so I know for a fact that his dog may not be the best trained around, but that he does have one.
Larry, thanks for being on
My
Animals
Voice
and the Idea of Political Etymology.
Thank you.
This is Peter Paul for Animals and Ideas. Thanks for listening.
Now, that was done a little while back, of course, and so to give you some updates and then what's coming up, which is relative, this was done for my Western Public Radio and KALW series. It's bloody cold. And Jerry Brown was out of office, and he did his very strange things and Linda Ronstadt thing. And then when he ran, I don't know if he got the dog when he was mayor of Oakland, do-nothing mayor, and then ran for his state attorney general and then acquired a wife. He had a black lab named Dharma, I think, and the dog recently died. He used to bring it to the office, the state attorney general's office. So currently he doesn't have a dog, as far as I know. And last we heard of Dharma, that Dharma went to his Hindu or whatever, I think Dharma is a Hindu name, reward. As part of the series that I did, I came across a tape in our archives of the PR person who, in effect, marketed General Eisenhower when General Eisenhower ran for president in 1952. And it's fascinating how he was marketed. I didn't even know this. I was a child when I first saw him. I was a little boy, and he was driving by and waving. I still have that image in my mind. And it's when he was running for president. But I'm editing it down, and we'll probably have that next week as part of our special series on Fleet Week here in San Francisco, when it's also the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Canadian Navy, and there's some fascinating things we'll have on that, and Canada's contributions to our military. Famous weapon they invented. Some of the people who were men who were born in Canada emigrated legally to the United States, served honorably, and be surprised at some of the names. And then the famous ship that the Canadians came up with to escort the convoys to England in the early part of the war, when England, when Hitler was trying to, with the submarines, were trying to starve the English out and into submission and surrender. So we'll have that. And then one with the, I did with, I think, the political director of the National Rifles Association. We're talking about hunting. And since we're since we're on that subject, getting back to Harry Truman, he was once asked, Harry Truman used to fish, and he would wear these outrageous shirts when he went down to Florida. And people, some of his enemies in the press, used to make fun of him. But somebody asked him, why don't you hunt? And even though fishing is a form of hunting, I guess. And he said, I don't believe in shooting at something that can't shoot back. And I think that's a very fair statement. That's typical of Harry Truman. And I was talking to someone today about Mr. O's career, academic career at Harvard Law School, and the subject of Harvard came up in the Truman administration when a question came up about Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of the State, and he had this British-style mustache. And I think he went to Harvard Law School, and Truman was asked the question about the state of the country and who his advisors were, and he said, if I listened to all the people from Harvard, the country would be in even worse shape. Interestingly, on the Supreme Court, since we did discuss that earlier in the show, John Roberts, I think Sam Alito, my favorite, the other Italian, and I think also our black member of the court, also the Jewish man Breyer. He went, so we have, it's interesting that most of our Supreme Court judges and a lot of our federal judges have gone to certain law schools, Harvard, Yale, University of Chicago. I don't think anybody went to UC Berkeley or maybe one went to Stanford. I'm not sure. I should do a little history of that since I did work in a federal courthouse when I was a student. But it's just interesting. And what's her name? The latest, the woman, one of the women, the alleged lesbian. She was appointed dean of Harvard Law School, and there's a coming scandal on how that happened with Larry Summers, excuse me, who was fired. What he said about women and a few other things, but a lot of our federal judges and Supreme Court justices are going to certain law schools, so that's something that people should be aware of, that there is kind of an aristocracy, academic aristocracy there. Let's see, what else was coming? And then, of course, we have the first Monday in October when the Supreme Court convenes. It'll be interesting to see what kind of cases. And, you know, they get about 10,000 cases come up there a year, and they rely on the what they call the cert pool, the certiorari pool, the staff attorneys and clerks to go through these things, call them. And, you know, they only – then they – the ones that are selected – the justices meet privately. No one else is supposed to be in the room, and they decide which cases they're going to hear, grant certiorari. And people should understand this: the fact that the Supreme Court does not grant certiorari is not based on the merits of the case, but on the relevance to the Supreme Court and sometimes the politics. And what's interesting is that the Supreme Court can only overrule itself. And all decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court in the famous case Jordan versus Gilligan, which is Stephen Airey quoted in his legal brief, that's stated there that only Supreme Court can overrule itself, and you can't have these local courts like they did in San Francisco defy the U.S. and the federal courts saying, you know, we're going to do this anyway, the hell with you, you know where to stick your gavel. That's what one of them said. Excuse me. But it's just fascinating what goes on. And we're seeing more and more cases coming up. They look for relevance. And one of the important things, and this will, they keep saying that the California, the U.S. District Court, Northern District's Walker decision on overturning Prop 8, and it's right now it's going to be, it's on an expedited track in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is like four blocks from the district courthouse, famous building, and we'll get into that about some of the famous cases there. One of the most expensive cases at the time, Tokyo Rose or Rose Dukino was tried there. There were a couple other cases where she was railroaded, and I was at the tail end of the appeal, not the appeal, but the appeal to grant her in the Ford administration to grant her a pardon. But she was clearly railroaded by and in the press by that moron Walter Winchell, who beat the drums in the newspapers and got all these people with all this false information about her making these broadcasts and that she was the Tokyo Rose, when in fact there were 20 girls, young women, in that radio announcers pool. And even the Australian and the Americans who were captured, who also were forced to make broadcasts, they testified on her behalf. And one guy lied. That's another story. A captain, I forgot his name. But anyway, and since there are decisions around the country, and also Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that's also Ninth Circuit, but that's a district court in the Central District of California, which is Los Angeles, and there's going to be a fight about that. So one of the purposes of the Supreme Court is to keep order among the circuits when you have this kind of conflict where one circuit, like Ninth Circuit, the judges will rule based on what their staff attorneys and clerks come up with, because a lot of these judges just do not have the time to do the research and to have that kind of what I call incandescent judicial mentality. Like Scalia, he's an incandescent intellect. I've read his stuff. I'm very impressed. You may not agree with him, but he's certainly one bright man and can sometimes be abrasive, but Scalia is a great scholar. Excuse me. Now, what happens is that they can expedite cases. Sometimes it takes forever to go through, and like a lot of the death penalty cases, we have, I think, about 30 to 40 people sitting on death row at San Quentin. They all go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. There's what they have, what I call the death watch, an office that's 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and I will get into that on my Amicus Veritas YouTube site. We just put up what could be the Tea Party's anthem, This Is My Country, which is the new theme, for this Blog Talk radio program. This Is My Country. It's an old song that was written just before World War II, I think by a person whose ancestry was Russian Jewish. And I think it's a great tune, and I hope you listen to it when you access the Amicus Veritas YouTube site, and there'll be more up on there. We have about 102 videos. There will be more. It's just a lot of editing, and I'm learning how to do this faster. And we'll have more interviews. I also, getting back to the subject of hunting, I came across a tape that I did with the nephew of Mahatma Gandhi. And we talk about this very subject, about animals and the Mahatma's philosophy and attitude toward animals. Quite interesting. And so I'm editing that, so we'll probably play that in the next 2 weeks. The other one is one of my great friends, someone I've known for years, Patrick Butler, of course, been around in media, Chicago, Cook County media, Illinois media for years. His grandfather was on the bridge of the Olympia, the USS Olympia, in the Spanish-American War, and he knew Admiral Dewey. Admiral Dewey, I think, died in Evanston, Illinois. But we'll be doing an interview with him and his views on Illinois and national politics, because he knew Obama and just about all these people, Mayor Daley, and what I call real politicians. You may not like them, but these guys knew politics, and it's not this namby-pamby quiche and Chablis and cocaine circuits that some of these politicians out here seem to circulate on, or the hot tubs and all of that. But we'll be talking about that. And then I have, going through the archives, I will probably do more on, I've been requested to do more of the interview, to broadcast more of the interview with Brigadier Ingle, because he was up in Afghanistan and Pakistan, what was known as a Northwest Frontier, for 30 years. He also went to Sandhurst, which is the British West Point, and one of his classmates was the actor David Niven. David Niven served in, he stopped his acting in World War II and joined the fight against Hitler and Mussolini. A lot of great people. And you know John Wayne. People trash John Wayne. John Wayne was also in the service. I think Humphrey Bogart may have also. I've got to check on that. But there's a lot of Hollywood actors, and there are going to be some surprises when I bring up the Canadians, one of my favorite subjects, because we don't give them credit, our neighbors to the north, for what they do and what they put up with, you know. So that ought to be interesting because it's a rarity. I've got to find it again, a guy who was in the British, what they call SOE, Special Operations Executive, which was our version of it's what we would call special ops, and how this guy was part of the operation to prevent Greece from turning communist after World War II. So it was fascinating what went on there. And then there's a famous movie that's connected to that whole episode. It's called Elena. Now, Eleni, it's about a woman who was tortured, horribly tortured in front of her children, and she wouldn't give in to the communists. And her son survived, and he went to work for the New York Times, and he wrote a book, which later became a movie, which starred one of my favorite actresses, Irene Pappas, classic face. So it's a lot of history, and we have a lot of that in the archives, and it's just a matter of editing it. And I've had some requests from military and historical archives around the world. I just haven't gotten around to some of it. We have one or two that the Michigan State Radio Archives, I think I sent a tape to them. So I have a lot, and I'm trying to get a lot of this done so it can be preserved for posterity. And it's stuff that, like Brigadier Colonel Hodges, Trevor Hodges, he served in the British Army at Gallipoli. He lied to get in, or his recruiter did, and he was invalided out. Not invalided, but he was sick. He came down with a flu or something, and he was evacuated on the sister ship of the Titanic. It was called the Britannic, and we don't know to this day whether it was sunk by a mine, a torpedo, or what, but he survived that. And then there was a depression in England, and he came over here with a lot of the British officers who were unemployed out of the army. And he told me in the interview that at the beginning of the war in Europe, that the call went out from what was called the War Department, which is now the U.S. Defense Department, or DOD, to these British officers to come into the United States Army and Armed Forces to train. Was they knew that we were going to go to war. And so there were about 10,000 of them. And he at the time said he had worked for Chrysler, which made the Sherman tank, I believe. Also, something just cropped up, and I'll get it up on the web. Turns out that there was a guy just died. He was a pilot for Pan American Airways and flew in the Pacific. And he, in his obituary, it was printed that he was flying that day, December 7th, or I guess it would be December 8th because they're a day ahead, if I got it right. Anyway, he was flying over the Pacific, and he looked down from the cockpit, and he saw this fleet of ships headed toward Hawaii. And he thought the White House should be warned, and he radioed ahead to Pan Am's headquarters. They, in turn, called the White House about this fleet of ships headed toward Hawaii. And, you know, people pretty well knew that these were Japanese. And they said, thank you, and then that was the end of it. And then, of course, we know what happened. The sailors were caught off guard. Some were attending church. Some were sleeping off hangovers. Some were playing baseballs. We've seen all the famous pictures. But this is an aspect of the Pearl Harbor controversy that has never come up. And I remember when I was at Western Public Radio, The guy who wrote At Dawn We Slept, he came over to do an interview, and I asked him a couple of questions. I said, is there anything else that hasn't come out about did we know, did we have prior knowledge, or did someone have prior knowledge about our warning that the Japanese were planning to attack Pearl Harbor? And he said, no. I forgot his name, but anyway, he wrote another book on Midway too. But At Dawn We Slept, and I did interview. I did talk to him. My boss, my teacher, Leo Lee, another interesting character. He did the interview. So this is fascinating that some other people knew that something was amiss and something was wrong, and they tried to give warning to the White House, and it just may have been a bungle. We don't know, but it's another part of history that's suddenly being revealed. And also on the Amicus Veritas YouTube site, we have Red's Java House. Now, Red was underage. I think he said he was 15. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to get him on tape, but he served on the USS Arizona and survived. And he had a picture. People used to come to Red's Java House, which was had the best dollar sandwich, ham sandwich, and hamburger in the city. And it was on the wharf, and the cops, and everybody used to come there and get a sandwich and get a beer or a glass of wine. Wine wasn't that good, or coffee, and sit outside and watch the seagulls. And remember, the police chief used to come there. But Red... He sold the place, and then he went into coaching this Irish boxer, and never heard anything since. I think he's still alive. He's, of course, he was 15 when he lied to get in the U.S. Navy, and he survived the sinking of the Arizona. So I have his Red's Java House on there. And whenever we have Fleet Week, usually, and when we have the Russian ship, the Vareg, here, they dock near there because it's a easy dock, and it's huge. Incidentally, I'm finishing this up. I just found out that in my legal research with Stephen Nery and some other military personnel, that there was a Russian sailor who filed. He was here in the United States, sent over, who filed a habeas corpus in the federal courts. It went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I'm going to get into that because it's this fascinating case that's not well, it's hardly known, but it's fascinating, and it's quite interesting. It's a part of history we don't know, and, of course, one of my favorite pairing people are accessing it. The Vareg is one of the popular YouTube, Amicus Veritas YouTube videos that I worked on. Since we have a few more minutes, I want to rerun. I'm going to run this since we still haven't learned. I discussed this today, Afghanistan, and it's just hopeless. It looks like we're going to be there forever with this. So, you know, we can't do anything to get to win this war. We can't bomb them back into the Stone Age because some of them are already there. So let me play this clip that we got. A Russian a film clip of the audio, a Russian captain who had experience in Afghanistan is lecturing these Russian draftees who are going to Afghanistan.
A minimum of knowledge necessary to interact with the locals. You'll find in this pamphlet here. Yeah. But the most important thing for you to remember when you cross the border is that you will be inside of an Islamic State. Islam is not just another religion. It's an entirely different world with its own set of laws, an alternate view of life, and of death. A true Muslim is not afraid to die in battle. And those who perish while fighting against the infidels, which is us, get a one-way ticket to heaven, where they will get everything they lack in this life. Water, bountiful harvest, and big bosomed virgins, boys. Relations with women in Islam is a separate conversation. The most sacred thing to a Muslim is his home, Haram. This is where the word harem comes from. The second meaning of this word is not allowed or forbidden. Looking at Muslim women, haram. Anything with sexual relation, haram. It's haram to show a Muslim any obscene gesture, which all of you are used to. For that, you can get a bullet from a peaceful civilian. On the other hand, a Muslim will never defile his own home with blood. The moment you step foot in a village, you are considered to be a guest. Killing a guest, even if it's an infidel, haram. So remember, never forget this. As long as you are within a village, you are safe. But the moment you step beyond its boundaries, the same host who was giving you tea 5 minutes ago can shoot you in the back with no hesitation. Because killing an infidel is an heroic deed. A stairway to heaven. I'm telling you this for your own sake. So here it is. Afghanistan. It is a multinational state with more than 20 ethnic groups living here. Tajiks, Turkmen, Uzbeks. Along the Pakistan border, you have the Pashtuns, and in the west, Khazars and other Mongolian tribes who settled here after the Mongol invasion in the 13th century. The word Khazar means 1,000 in the Turkic languages. Soldier, is this not interesting to you?
Comrade Captain, does it make a difference who we kill?
In all of history, no one has ever managed to conquer Afghanistan.
The reason I play that is because we still have people thinking, or at least they're talking this talk, some of them are not walking the walk, that we can win, quote, whatever that means, in Afghanistan. And I heard the same thing about Vietnam. And we didn't win, we were forced out. And Brigadier Ingalls said the same thing, that the British, and this is irrefutable fact, had 4 wars up there. The Russians were meddling, and they've had their own problems. And, of course, they had the 10-year war with the Afghans. And look what we got, these crazed Talibans. And I always said that there are 3 things that don't go together, religion and politics, a very deadly sexual preference in politics, and race in politics. These are 3 deadly ingredients that should never be mixed with politics, and it just does not work for the Christian West, but these crazy Muslims and whatever else you want to call them. But my view is, from what I know about the history of Afghanistan, is that the best thing we can do is to contain the bastards. And of course we're going to have problems with Pakistan because we don't know who to trust or why to even trust these people, considering, they're Muslims too, and there's quite a bit of political duplicity. And one of the, it's interesting, one of their dictators, I think it was General Zia, he came to Washington. This was, I think, time of Lyndon Johnson, and he made this outrageous statement that we owed them, that we have an obligation to them, and it didn't sit too well. Of course, it was like Calderon, who came to a joint session of Congress and made this outrageous statements and behavior. I mean, if one of our leaders went to the Mexican senator, their Congress, made these statements, there would be more than shoes thrown at them. It'd be rotten tomatoes and tamales and everything else. So, it's just a situation that we have to take a hard look at, that is this thing winnable? Another issue, now, I was just told that this Colonel Lakin, his court-martial, he's challenged Mr. Rowe to produce the birth certificate, because he said if you're not an American citizen, you weren't born here, then as commander-in-chief, your orders are invalid. I don't have to, you know, in effect, I cannot, under the Constitution, my oath, obey them. And he's not the only one saying this. So there's a lot of controversy about this court-martial of him. Now, I just learned this morning. I was talking to somebody about General Eisenhower, and I brought up how he was marketed. And this is not well known. Dwight Eisenhower was born in Abilene, Texas. And there was no birth certificate. In fact, the courthouse in one of the Texas counties was burned down, and all the records were destroyed. So what happened, his parents, I think, or his mother and his brother, I think his father had died, had to sign an affidavit of his birth. And, of course, Eisenhower went to West Point, and he served honorably in the U.S. Army, great commander, supreme allied commander in Europe. He worked with General Douglas MacArthur and said he learned dramatics from MacArthur. But Eisenhower, the family moved to Kansas, and I think that's when the issue of his birth came up. So this is not a new thing about verifying the birth of a political and national leader, and certainly someone who's commander-in-chief. It also came up in the McCain when he ran for Senate, because he was born in the Canal Zone down there, although his parents were Americans. So demanded, and he did produce a verifiable birth certificate. So, again, I don't understand why Mr. Roe doesn't deal with this and just say if he's got it, produce it and tell everybody shut the you-know-what up. So, and of course, the guy who started this was Bill Richardson. French TV caught him, who made the statement at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, said that Obama is an immigrant. He's one of us. And, in fact, Bill Richardson was born in Mexico. His father was American, but his dark skin comes from his Mexican mother. He speaks Spanish very well, I understand, which we could say the rest about his politics. But anyway, that's where that's at. Anyway, I'll play our favorite theme, and it won't go away. In fact, Tom Bosley starred in his show. He's long since dead. Excuse me. Got this cold still. So here goes.
Say, Ben, want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bets.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Okay, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Five,
two.
Gentlemen. Here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where's the cash?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's it going? We should make Jack Riley the guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack B or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of jacks, bat out.
Politics and poker, shuffle up some cards and find the joker. Need a game for children, need a game is rough. Decisions
like
who to pick,
how to play,
what to bet, when to call
a bluff. All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Paraphrase.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Great to find.
I'll call.
I'll call.
Well, hopefully we won't have any jokers this coming November. It's a little over a month. So thank you for tuning in. And, of course, this will remain up in the archives for those who couldn't listen live at this time. And, again, go to Amicus Veritas, our YouTube site, and also the major blog site, amicusveritas.org. So we'll see you next week for a special Fleet Week. Good night.